Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? Most people don't think about their space as an Airbnb, but hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle. If you have a home but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by writer, director, and actor, Benny Safdie. Up until a couple years ago, Benny had primarily been one half of a directing duo alongside his brother, Josh. Together, they made pulse-pounding, anxiety-inducing films like Daddy Long Legs, Good Time, and most recently, Uncut Gems, starring Adam Sandler. But then, suddenly, over this past summer in GQ magazine, Benny announced that he wouldn't be co-directing the next movie with his brother. The split, he said, is a natural progression for how things have happened. And really, what's happened is that, since the pandemic, Benny has emerged as an excellent supporting actor. Since 2021, he's been enlisted by auteurs like Paul Thomas Anderson for Licorice Pizza, Claire Denis for Stars at Noon, and of course, Christopher Nolan for what has become a Best Picture frontrunner in Oppenheimer. His latest project is called The Curse, which Benny co-created with comedian Nathan Fielder. Set in a small New Mexico town, the show follows a newlywed couple struggling to bring their vision for eco-conscious housing to life. Their seemingly well-intentioned efforts, emphasis on seemingly, are then complicated by Dougie, a reality TV producer played by Safdie, who sees a potential HGTV program in their story. Here's a clip from the trailer.
There's no such thing as a perfect city, but to me, this city is as close as it comes. That's why we're proud to call Española my home. Oh, shit. Our home.
All right, you got it. It's okay.
God. This isn't your typical home flipping show.
My homes are reflecting the local community.
Come on.
And we're husband and wife.
This is Kevin Brown.
So what could go wrong?
Let's grab a quick shot of you giving money to that little girl over there.
We're doing good here. We are good people.
Thank you.
We're really good.
Got it.
So all I had on me was that $100 bill.
A refund.
That's not fair.
It is fair.
Let me go get change and...
What is that?
That's nothing.
This is... You don't need to see this.
Why did you snatch back the money? Why didn't you just give her the 100?
I was going to buy 6 of them for $20.
I curse you.
What did she say?
That was from The Curse. You can stream new episodes of the show every Friday at midnight on Paramount Plus or the Showtime On Demand app. We untangled this new show a bit more at the top of our conversation, but it's a fitting next step for Safdie, who's long interrogated our ideas of authenticity and realism in film. It's an obsession that dates back to childhood, he told me, coming of age in the 1990s as Josh and him split time between his father in Queens and his mother in Manhattan. We talk about all that as well. And then finally, we discuss Benny's affinity for Fielder's previous program, Nathan For You, his full circle moment of playing an astrophysicist in Oppenheimer, and how making deeply personal films has reconfigured the way he views his past and his present. That's all coming up next with actor, writer, and director Benny Safdie.
Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. Our Airbnb even had a balcony that overlooked the Colosseum. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? You could just host a spare extra room, or you could Airbnb your whole home while you're away to earn some extra money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello. Malcolm Gladwell here from Revisionist History. If you've watched a professional tennis match recently, you'll know that fans have this amazing new tool at their disposal. It was created by the consulting company Infosys and the Association of Tennis Professionals. It's an immersive 3D viewing experience for tennis fans, which allows them to watch matches from new angles, get real-time statistics, and better understand the inner workings of the game and its athletes. Basically, a completely new data-driven way to appreciate a tennis match. It's been a huge hit, and I'm proud to say that the Infosys tennis platform earned first place in the customer experience category at the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business, an event held at Mobile World Congress in Las Vegas that celebrates customers who've boldly innovated for the sake of meaningful change. And I think it's important to point out that innovation like this doesn't just require a great idea and exploit some great underlying technology. It takes courage. Because tennis is a game with a long history and some pretty powerful traditions. I mean, you can only wear white at Wimbledon. Still, it's the 21st century. And here was an idea that said we can dramatically change the way a fan watches a match. We can feed them data. We can allow them to see things they could never see before with the naked eye, or even conventional camera angles. If you want to turn a world upside down, you have to have a pretty strong backbone. That's a lot of what the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards are all about. Finding people and companies who show that kind of boldness. I encourage you to enter. It's a fantastic event and a great way to be recognized for your brave, outside-the-box thinking in front of the industry's most influential leaders, and an even better way to say, I told you so. You can enter by July 31st at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. That's T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank NA, member FDIC.
Mm-hmm. Benny Safdie.
Hello.
Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you as well.
How are you feeling?
I am okay. A little tired.
Best way to start a podcast.
Yes. No, no, no. It's. I was actually just thinking of, there was a stand-up that I used to do as a character, Ralph Handel.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the opening jokes was, hey, everybody, how you all doing? And everybody's like, woo. And then I'd be like, how am I? And then everybody would wait for the punchline. I'd say, hey, I'm a little tired, a little hungry, but I'm okay.
Can we start with this new show of yours? It's called The Curse.
Yes.
You co-created it with Nathan Fielder.
Yes.
But Fielder is someone whose work you've long admired, right?
Because yes.
Back in 2016, you wrote an essay in CinemaScope.
Yes.
About his show, Nathan For
Pretty
You.
Pretty long, too. I was watching Nathan For You when it was linear.
Right.
I was waiting week to week for this thing. And this was about Smokers Allowed.
Yes.
Which I thought was an unbelievable thing. And it was just, I don't know, it was interesting because I'm obsessed with realism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's part of just something that's always in my head. And then when I saw that episode, I was like, oh, this guy is also into something kind of similar, you know? And I was really excited by that. But in this essay,
which I'm happy to quote from.
Go for it.
You write, when you become obsessed with creating realism, you create something fake. Fielder is truly a national treasure. He has somehow melded Jacques Tati and Mark Cuban.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. So that's what I want to ask you. I want to start here. When The Curse came together, how did you reimagine this collaboration between the two of you? Did he play Tati and you played like James Dolan?
It's funny because after this, he had seen, I think it was Good Time.
Doesn't take the bait on the Dolan slander.
No, okay. Please. I love the Knicks. We're figuring things out. And I think we're going to be a good team this year.
They've been figuring things out way like my mom would say, I'm figuring things out with your third stepfather.
Yes, but eventually things will work out. You'll find the right person, you'll click, and then you'll have a happy life together.
I'll send this tape to my mom.
So basically what happened was, is we kind of just met up as mutual, I guess, fans of one another. And every time I was out in LA, we would just meet up and talk. And it was just in these initial meetings that kind of we came up with the idea for the show, just like accidentally.
You said that like it was a question.
Yeah. Well, because it's like, it was weird because as we came up with it, we were like, nah, this isn't going to work. You know, it was so backhanded, offhand that we kind of just let it go. And then we would text one another, just compounding on the idea every once in a while. And I think at some point we were like, I think we have to make this thing. You know, that's kind of where it ended up.
So now that it's out in the world and it's being released every week, how would you explain what this is?
Oof, I don't know if I want that responsibility. I guess it's about, it's hard because I don't want to pigeonhole it into any specific.
If I do this for you as an act of generosity.
Yes, maybe then I'll jump in and
you'll
add.
You'll have to return. All right.
Okay.
So it's set in New Mexico.
Yes.
In a town called Española.
Yes.
There's a couple, the Seagulls, played by Fielder and Emma Stone, and they're creating a sort of HGTV pilot.
Okay, so here now I can take over because I thought you wanted me to get really deep and like philosophical about it. I can summarize.
We start on the surface and then we go deeper.
So essentially it's about Whitney and Asher Siegel. They have a HGTV show and they want to kind of figure out a way to increase the environmental sustainability of a community,
mm-hmm.
but doing so without any consequences regarding gentrification or anything in that neighborhood. So they try their hardest to not do that. The show is called Fliplanthropy. And it's a mix of flipping homes and fliplanthropy. Philanthropy. You know, it's like from now on, now I can't even think of the word philanthropy without saying fliplanthropy.
After watching the show, you almost never want to think of philanthropy ever again.
Ever again, because philanthropy is now, I guess it's a bad word.
It's cursed.
Yeah, it's cursed. And so it's funny because there was a long discussion between me and Nathan. Is it fliplanthropy or fliplandthropy? And we wanted to have the D or not have the D. It was a very long discussion.
Regardless, the log line is saving the world 1 kilowatt at a time.
Which is true. And then I play the producer of that said show. And the curse follows us as we move through the town of Española in New Mexico, Santa Fe, and what it's like to just kind of be in that area.
So that's the surface description.
Yes. And it's funny.
It's
scary and it's sad. Basically what happened was, is I was like, oh, so what was it like when you first moved to LA? And he's like, oh, I had just moved here and I didn't even have an American cell phone, because I don't know if anybody knows, Nathan Fielder is from Canada.
Yes.
So
famous.
And he needed to get a new cell phone. So he, on his way to the cell phone store, somebody asked him for money. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I don't have anything. And then they said to him, I curse you. And he kind of took that, went on to the store, and it made him feel very uncomfortable. So he then left, went to an ATM, took out $20 and gave it to the person who was on the street and said, is the curse lifted? And they said, yes, it is. So then the conversation became, well, what if it wasn't? What if she wasn't there? You know, mm-hmm. I said to him, like, what if you went to the ATM and came back and the person wasn't there? Then would the curse still be there?
Right.
Would it affect your mental state for the rest of your life? That was the seed of it. And then we realized that became a good kind of template for something. And I guess at the time I had been in a doctor's office a lot, because I guess it was my wife was their first child and I was there a lot. I was sitting in the waiting room and it was just HGTV all the time. House Hunters, Flip or Flop, all these other things. And what you end up seeing is that, yes, it's reality television.
Right.
But there's only so much you can hide from the cameras. You can get a kind of really good sense of the relationships between the two people in the show.
Right.
You know, you can really understand if there's marital issues or if there's tension. Because they're not really spending that much time. They're really moving quickly. So you could get at like little glances and you'll understand who they are. And that's also just in Nathan's work in general. So it kind of, again, was this amazing synergy between the two of us of like, okay, what can we bring to this? And it was an amazing kind of collaboration.
You mentioned your character, Dougie.
Dougie Schechter.
Glad we have the full name on record here. He's this long-haired producer with rectangular glasses.
Yes.
Who's especially good at seeding conflict mm-hmm. between the central couple, played by Fielder and Emma Stone. He's good at manipulating the setting and sometimes even recreating events and filming them as if they were happening extemporaneously. And I wonder, did playing this part bring you back to your early upbringing in Queens, where your father would often instigate trouble the way Dougie does, creating home movies with you and your brother Josh, waking you up in the middle of the night to reenact fights you had the day before? I'm thinking, when you're making this new show, were you brought back to all of that?
Yeah, it's definitely, well, I grew up in Queens and Upper West Side, Manhattan, but I don't know where I'm pulling what from. There's definitely probably something like that in there. Dougie's this guy who always wants everybody to be happy, you know, and that means he'll say one thing to one person and another thing to the other person. And then he believes both exactly the same. And then when he's on his own, both of those disappear. So he truly is a mover and a shaker in that sense. And I think he just really wants to be successful. His ambition there is just kind of naked, and he will literally, whatever I got to do to make this thing interesting or fun, because what I'm watching here sucks. So it's like, I just want to do the best thing I can. And hey, that's conflict. You know, I got to find out the conflict here. And I guess with regards to the home movie, yeah, he just wanted to make something interesting, you know.
But you, it is. You mean by home movie, you mean your father?
Yeah.
Did you find it interesting?
As a kid?
Yeah.
I didn't know what was going on. You know, it's like, I was just like, what? I'm waking up and what are you filming me for? And it is interesting. I do the same thing with my two sons. I'll film them. And every once in a while, they're like, what's going on? What are you filming me for? We're literally doing nothing. But I'm always like, okay, this is going to be interesting for them in some way, because I'm more appreciative of it now.
That's kind of what I want to talk.
Yeah.
I want to talk about growing up, because now you're a father.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you've been like reprocessing some of those memories.
Well, I definitely had a playbook of what not to do, but there is just this idea that everything can be interesting in some way,
right.
You know? But then again, that goes back to, you can look at certain movies, you know, you have the neorealist movies, you have the Iranian cinema, where all of these people are making movies about reality, or they're with people they know. You have Bicycle Thieves, literally using the people coming out of the stadium and incorporating that into the show or into the movie. And so I guess there's this idea that your life can be interesting, or whatever it is that you're experiencing or feeling is important. And so if it's just a matter of how you frame it.
I want to understand, it's like growing up, your father would often say, that the answers to life's questions are found in movies.
He never said that. He never said that.
Josh phrased it once as that.
That was an interpretation.
Okay, an interpretation. Because
I don't think he was as aware of what he was doing there. He was just filming.
Right.
I think that's an important distinction, though, is that he was never like, this is what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm making this. I'm making that. It was just a byproduct of that.
But when your parents separate,
yeah,
he does show you Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, they were separated from when I was very young.
Right.
So
6 months?
Yes. So basically at one point when things were getting back into us kind of going back with our mom, he showed us Kramer versus Kramer.
Right.
Yes. To frame the situation positively in his favor. So
this is propaganda.
Yes, 100% propaganda. And that's not fair. You know, it's like, I'm too young. I shouldn't even be watching the movie now. It's so traumatizing. But
I felt the same way.
It's great.
When you watched that film.
Yeah.
And you were going back and forth between like Queens and Manhattan.
Yeah.
How did you make sense of what you were watching?
As a kid, it's simple. It's not, I guess now when you watch it, you see the complexities of it. But as a kid, he's good, she's bad. That's what you get.
Right.
So that's what he knew was going to happen. So it's
did
like,
you believe that in your life about your own parents?
No, of course not.
Right.
You know, that was what I was told in that moment. And so, of course, she was very upset. And of course, my stepfather's upset where he's like, what are you doing? Like, why are you coming here with this, like, this attitude? And then everybody finds out and it's definitely insane. But as a kid, you associate yourself with the kid in the movie. And the kid in the movie is sad. So that's what you feel.
This is a clip from the 1979 film, Kramer versus Kramer.
I don't understand.
Well, the problem is that your mommy and I both want you to live with us, see? So that's why we decided to go see this man, who I told you is the judge. And we let him decide because he's very wise and experienced about these things. See, we talked to him for a few days, and after that, we asked him what he thought. You know what he said? He agreed with mommy. He thought it would be a terrific idea if you move in with her and live there from now on. And I'm really lucky because I get to have dinner with you once a week. And two times a month, we spend the weekends together.
Where's my bed gonna be? Where am I gonna sleep?
Oh, well, mommy's figured that all out. You have your own bedroom at her place?
Where are my toys gonna be?
At mommy's. We're gonna take all your toys over there. If you play your cards well, I bet you should buy you some new ones.
Who's gonna read me my bedtime stories?
Mommy will.
You're not gonna kiss me tonight anymore, are you, Dad?
No, I won't be able to do that. But, you know, I'll get to visit.
Are your parents divorced?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I was gonna say, your parents split up 6 months. Mine were 10 months.
Okay.
You are the first guest to beat me.
Well, this is the way
it's the worst race to run.
It is. It's the worst. Well, think about it as a race to existence. We just snuck in. Clearly, something happened where it was like, either let's give it one more shot or whoops. Like,
yes.
I guess let's see how this pans out. Not going to work. It's had its effect on me in some
way. Well, you've made a lot of films about it.
Yes. To go back to that, what I said before, if there's a kernel of truth within inside of you or whatever, it's easier to talk about or make something because you understand where it's coming from, you know? So that's just like, what's my motivation?
You know, growing up with a video camera always around, recreating events, living out moments of your life on tape when you didn't know you were being filmed, obviously that would tie into later movies that you two would make.
Mm-hmm.
But do you remember the first time you and Josh commandeered the camera and like began making your own projects?
Well, there was a weird smoking commercial, I remember, and it was just like, we knew he watched the tape, so we did something to like...
like a PSA?
Yeah, it was something like that. But I think that there's something about, I guess, that's early 90s that this was happening. And I guess that was the first consumer cameras that were out there. So I think a lot of people from that time period did grow up under this idea that there's more accessibility to something that felt so far away. And again, there was also this weird moment, I think, early on when point-and-shoot cameras started having video on them, and people didn't necessarily know when they were being filmed. So there was a lot of honesty that you could capture. I think people now are a little bit more aware of cameras and stuff like that. But there's been kind of, so there was this moment where nobody knew they were filming. Then there was this moment where everybody knew that they were being filmed and they were always on watch and always vigilant. And now I feel like there's this, yeah, I'm being filmed. I'm just going to say, right, fuck it. I'm just going to live my life. I don't care. That's
so yeah, we've been worn down.
Exactly. So it's like, I can't. And it's the kind of thing also, it's like, I remember there was one time where I was in, I guess I was on Bleecker Street, and I walked by where Robert Frank lived, and I saw him on his bed, laid back in repose, and I was like, this is unbelievable. Love Robert Frank. I also take photographs. I happen to have my medium format camera with me, so I take out my camera, and I go to take a picture of him in this kind of state, and some hand comes in and says, how dare you? And she slams the door. And the picture I ended up getting was of this hand pulling the door closed. It wasn't him who slammed the door, but whoever closed the door, I was like, this is what he did all the time.
Right.
You know, all he did was sneak photos of people. That was like the first version of the home video camera. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact once the camera was given to people and you can capture, I think Gary Winograd is a good example where you have all of these photos of interesting things, mm-hmm, people, and they're captured in a way that is just like, oh my God, that's artistic, that's art or whatever, or maybe it's not, maybe it's just, but he had a very specific knack for finding these moments. And Lee Friedlander's one, William Eggleston, Joel Meyerowitz, you know, you have all the Helen Levitt, you have all these people who were finding these moments. And at that time, it was very weird to have a camera and go and take pictures of,
right,
in Helen Levitt's case, a whole family crammed into a phone booth. You know, like, that's an amazing picture. And it's an amazing moment. And you could even say it's an amazing movie because you can see all the people's emotions on their faces. So there is this idea of watching and being watched that's definitely in the curse, you know, that there's this idea that somebody's always there looking, you know?
I would say that naturalistic, impromptu spirit is embedded in all of the movies you've made.
Yeah.
And so, like, in the beginning, you talked about how your dad used film as, like, a tool for propaganda. At some point when you two start working, you and Josh, did it feel like an act of rebellion? Did you feel like you were creating in contrast to that?
I guess with the propaganda element was just, you can, for better or worse, use movies to connect to your emotional state of mind. I think you can go to the Russians and see that they looked at movies as a way to essentially as a form of warfare, you know, and like propaganda, where you have all these films that are speaking about the Russian way of life and this idea of the power of movies to tell you what to feel and think. And so it's in that long lineage of things. And it was just a matter of you're trying to understand stuff. You can make it up, you can mess around, and you just want to understand what's, sometimes it might be, oh, how do I say this better in this technology? Or is this funny? If I hold it here, is this good? You know, so you're just kind of trying to understand it. You just have to always be looking around and listening. And when you cast somebody, that changes things. And I think specifically with The Curse, we were told like, oh, you can't really cast real people in a television show. It's different in a movie because it's a one-time thing or whatever. But like in a show that's over 70 days, it's going to be very difficult. I'm like, why? What's the big deal? So it became that like if somebody was submitting a tape, the more vertical video that you got on the street, that's what we looked for, mm-hmm, was somebody who never ever thought about being in a movie or a TV show or anything. That's who we wanted in the show. And so we cast a lot of people just from the area. And then as you're doing that, you're talking to them, you're trying to understand, you're changing things with them. So Nathan and I were always rewriting it to, mm-hmm, fit the people who we were casting. It's just, again, it goes back to this idea that you can use this to understand people or things better.
By literally incorporating people, I mean, again, your body of work, going from Daddy Long Legs to heaven knows what,
mm-hmm,
the short films before that, the implementation of street casting,
yeah,
with you and, you know, and
so important,
Jen Venditti and all, yeah, those people. Where do you think that came from? Is that the Bresson,
yeah,
naturalism?
Yeah, I think it's there's the Bresson, there's the neorealist, you know, and it's also in these documentaries from the 60s. You have all these, like, I think if you look at High School, which I actually just showed at NYU, I played Wiseman's high school. There's this one moment where this father is in the principal's office and he's so upset that his daughter got a failing grade on her exam. And yet on the paper, the teacher wrote the word fabulous or something like that. And he's sitting there and he's got this really small shirt, tie, like literally he's a massive, like a big, strong guy. And he's sitting in the chair and he could barely like move because his tie, he's going to the principal. So he put on his tie and he put on his button down and he's sitting there and he's in just complete disbelief. And he's like, she said fabulous. She said it. What's going on here? I don't understand. She gets an F, but fabulous. What's going on? And he won't stop, but he's such a character. So there's this idea that people kind of are iconographic of themselves in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. And so you can use that to enhance the emotions of a story. And in the early short films, I remember I was like, okay, here I am. And if I'm going to be in them, I have a relationship with this person. Just purely on a level of practicality, I know I can get a good performance because we're friends. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we can just talk. We can forget about that thing over in the corner filming this.
Those early first three films, in terms of the dynamic between you and Josh, you said once that we help each other see something different, a full vision of truth. He'll let me see things I don't see and I'll help him see things he doesn't see. We complement each other. We fill in each other's blind spots. How would you describe your blind spots and how would you describe his?
I guess let's just take Daddy Long Legs, for example. I was very quick to be critical of my father for the things that he did. And he would be more forgiving of those said things. And by putting those two perspectives together, you're able to get kind of a truer portrait.
Right.
Because you're not just saying this is bad and you're not just saying this is the best thing in the world. So it's just a matter of complementing different points of view and just taking that into consideration, really, which some people don't do. You know, it's my way or the highway is a lot of people's mentalities. Mm-hmm. So just this idea that you can get at a deeper thing through like that collaboration, you know?
There's a line in a 2012 short film of yours, The Black Balloon.
Yes.
And a character says, I love you as a human being, but I hate you as a person.
Yeah. You can like the idea of somebody
right.
and hate them. I think that's probably, you know, that you can think back and be like, oh, because I guess also with distance comes that, you know, that where I don't know if you've ever had somebody in your life where you're like, the longer you go without seeing them, you're like, oh, I really miss that person.
Right.
And then you see them and you're like, oh, fuck that person. You know, it's like, it's kind of that, where it's the moment you're in the room, you remember everything it was that made you so upset or angry. There's that phrase, so-and-so, something makes the heart grow fonder, right?
Distance.
Distance makes the heart grow fonder. That's very true.
Yeah. And familiarity breeds contempt.
Yes, exactly. So these are cliches for a reason.
Right.
So I think that's what that means there.
Guys, do you have this quote that's been really nagging me this whole week? I want to understand it. You mentioned Daddy Long Legs. You said the whole point of Daddy Long Legs was to relive our childhood, but it kills it at the same time. What was that like?
Well, what was that like? What, to kill your childhood?
Yeah, I mean,
that's therapy, right? That's therapy. Is you're reliving it to kind of close it up and understand
yeah.
it, because there's a lot of loose ends and loose emotions and. By going in and trying to, I guess I said, what did I say, recreating it is...
Yeah. When you become obsessed with creating realism,
yes.
you create something fake.
Yes. So it kind of ties into that where once you're going so deep into the understanding of where something comes from
right.
and how do you do it, to get that how do you do it to the level of something on the screen, there's so many steps that you have to break down. Who's it going to be? How are they going to say it? What are the lines they're going to say? When they say the lines, that sounds bad. You got to change it. So you're literally getting so granular into the actual thing that it's dead, you know? So you forget the original emotion that was there because now it's this new different thing.
It's complicated by a more technical process.
Yeah. Once you put it all out there and you look at it and you try and understand it, you get granular in a way that kind of kills the haziness of it. A memory is such a beautiful thing, But it's also very sad because you're never going to be able to go back there. So you have this fleeting moment of recognition. And it's sad. It's sad when that's away. But when you think of nostalgia, you have that moment and then it's still nostalgic, because it would be one thing if you're like, okay, I'm going to completely recreate that exact moment. I want to create deja vu. Whenever you go and try and do that, it's not the same.
No.
You know, you can go back and watch the shows that you watched as a kid, but it's not going to be in the same exact situation and feeling that you're in that you watched it. And I don't know, with Dai Lung, this was very important because it was confronting a lot of things that maybe weren't confronted.
Like what?
Emotional childhood stuff. You know, it's not fun.
It's a hard.
Yeah.
I rewatched it. It's
there's like an argument that's happening on the phone in front of the two kids that I just was like, it's yeah. intense.
Sage, what's shaking? What's happening, kiddo? Very good. Very good. Listen. Will you put your mom on? Will you put your mom on for me?
Okay. Here she is. It's Dad.
Lenny? Well, you know, it's 6 o'clock. I'm making dinner. What's up?
Do this part again. Do that part again.
I've got Carmen coming tomorrow. No, but tomorrow is a half day, and I've got plans to take the kids to see my folks this weekend. Okay, so it's not gonna happen. It's a half day. Right, and I've paid Carmen in advance. She's coming to get the kids, so it's not gonna work. I understand that you miss the kids, that's great, but you know what? Frankly, you're lucky you even see the kids.
What I look at in my life is like, there's certain things that happen to you and allow you to understand them. Because I feel like if I was on one track, I'd have no way of making sense of this. You know, mm-hmm. I'd be in the corner drooling, you know, which sometimes I am. But when I went to my mom and my stepfather, it was a very different world. You know, it was a very much more structured, and it allowed me like this kind of safe place to then look back and understand what was good, what was bad. And then as like a coping mechanism, though, I'm going to just look at this good stuff, you know? Mm. And then later on in life, you look at the bad stuff. But it allowed me the ability to put a sentence together, I guess. So...
You've put a series of compelling sentences together.
I appreciate that.
Just now. We'll be right back with actor, writer, and director, Benny Safdie.
Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. Our Airbnb even had a balcony that overlooked the Colosseum. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? You could just host a spare extra room, or you could Airbnb your whole home while you're away to earn some extra money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello. This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. In my book, David and Goliath, I tried to figure out how some people find the strength to take on the established way of thinking and turn it upside down. What does it take to be a disruptor? And I concluded that a disruptor is someone with a rare combination of three traits. First, you have to be open. You have to be willing to see and do things in new ways. Secondly, you have to be conscientious, to follow through and make things happen. Those two are obvious, but the third one is the crucial one. You have to be willing to do what you think is right, even when everyone around you thinks you're an idiot. There isn't a brilliant innovator in history who wasn't surrounded by naysayers. Most of us can't take that kind of criticism and we fold, but the disruptor doesn't. They soldier on. I've been looking at disruptors and their success stories a lot lately, partly because I'm working on a follow-up to The Tipping Point, and market disruption plays a key role in how ideas take off, but also because I'm going to be the keynote speaker at this year's Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business. It's an event where customers are recognized for kicking convention to the curb to elevate their company, while also doing meaningful things for their community and even the world. In fact, I'll be presenting the first ever Tipping Point designation, a new special distinction honoring one entrant that sparked transformative change for their organization. If this event sounds like your thing, I encourage you to find out more or even enter the unconventional awards to be recognized for your disruptive thinking. Win a donation to a charity of your choice, and much more. You can enter before July 31st at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. I'll save you a seat.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank N.A. member FDIC.
After you made Long Legs, there's Heaven Knows What, which Robert Pattinson fell in love with to the point where he emailed you out of the blue and asked to work on something. Mm-hmm. But until that point, you and Josh were trying to find your way in New York making movies. And this is how your collaborator, Ronnie Bronstein, described those years. Before Pattinson showed up, we'd been existing like a strand of saliva hanging from a barnyard animal, blowing in the wind, waiting to snap. There's the saliva again.
Yeah, there's the saliva.
Is that what it felt like?
Well, no, there was definitely, so after Daddy Long Legs, like, oh, great, got this thing, Spirit Award, you're in the industry. And then it's just fall flat on your face. You know, literally I stood in front of IFC Center with a billboard over my body, like one of those sandwich boards, convincing people to go into our movie over Ken Loach's movie, which is what IFC was putting all their money behind, because I was dedicated to making our movie held over in theaters. So I would literally stand online and tell people, what are you seeing? And they'd say, oh, I'm going to go see this. And I said, oh, you should think about going to Daddy Long Legs. They said, why? And I was like, well, I made it. You should go see it. And they were just like, excuse me? And I remember the IFC people like, oh, this is cute. This guy is like, it's a little, some sort of a...
Entrepreneurial?
It wasn't entrepreneurial. I think they were a little bit more dismissive of it. Like, oh, isn't this cute? He's going to be here for a couple, like an hour, and then he's going to leave. I was there for 8 hours a day.
Committed.
I had a spot in their closet where I would keep my stuff, and I would come back the next day and do the same thing because it had to be held over. And I think it played in that theater for a long, long time. But it was just, that's where I was kind of first confronted with this idea that, like, just because there's something that you find interesting doesn't mean the world is going to discover it.
Right.
They need to find out that this thing exists. You know, like we all thought making that this was going to be divorce 50% of people. We were convinced this was going to be like the TBS movie of the week, you know, but it wasn't. So, but it did give us something. But then when that didn't work out, you're just like, okay, well, now what? You're kind of back to square zero and you're trying to make something, you know. Then I think there was a documentary, Lenny Cook, that started, that was in that process. And then that took a long time, 3-4 years to right. finish that. So each movie you make, you're like, okay, now this is going to be the springboard, and it's not. And then you kind of fail. And it came to me basically right after Good Time, where it was like, okay, I just had my first son. If this doesn't work out, it's over. I'm not going to be making movies anymore because it's not fair. It's not fair to my wife who was working. It was almost like this fallacy that I had because everybody was, we kept doing all this stuff and it kept kind of, it had an impact, but it wasn't allowing me to make a living, you know? So I had to confront that and say, well, what is it? And so if that didn't work, it would have snapped and it would have been all over.
If
you know?
Good Time didn't work?
Yeah, you know? So, but each one was just enough to get a little bit more, but with Heaven Knows What, it was less money than Daddy Long Legs. So It was going backwards, and then the documentary was nothing, you know? It was just, we had gotten this footage from the producer, and he had been filming Lenny back then, and he's like, I don't know what to do with this. Can you help me? And then...
It's an old family friend of yours.
Yes, this guy, Adam Shopcorn, and he had all this stuff, but he stopped filming after he didn't make it into the draft. It was like, ugh. So what happened? That became the question. And then you have to sit with it and figure out how to best tell that story.
But it's funny because the story of Lenny Cook is this young basketball player who was like high school ranked, played against LeBron and Carmelo Anthony, was better than them at times.
Yeah.
And the story is heartbreaking in many ways because it doesn't work out the way you'd hope it would.
Lost potential is one of the most upsetting things, specifically in America.
Yes, but it happens very quick for him.
Yeah.
And what you're describing for you and Josh is that it happened in like fits and starts. It was gradual.
Yeah. Well, I guess because think about it. 2008 is when we made Daddy Long Legs. Good Time came out 2016.
Right.
And then Uncut Gems came out in 2019. That's a long time. It's almost 11 years. You know, when I looked back on Daddy Long Legs, I was like, oh my God, that was 10 years ago? That was 2018. I remember there was in 2014, I think it was, or it might have been 2014. Yes, because it was right before Cosmo, my son, was born. I went to Melbourne and they did a retrospective of our stuff. And I was really kind of like weirded out by that because I'm like, is this it? This is the end? Like, what are they doing? And it would just felt very strange because it was weird because, yes, like these fits and starts. I was like, oh, wow. We'd made all these short films and it was just kind of, we were always trying to figure something out. You know, we were constantly moving forward, trying to just experiment.
But up until Good Time, you said this thing, if it doesn't work here, it's not fair to my family. It's not fair to my wife.
Yes.
When you would have those conversations with her, would she go, maybe it's time for something else?
Well, it was me saying, because it was just, Cosmo was two weeks old when we started shooting Good Time. And then I was literally editing with the baby monitor on his naps because I was at home editing on that. And then I'd bring the footage. Ronnie and I was editing other scenes and we were literally working separately. But I was working from home and I just was like, okay, it's not fair that like she can't experience this the same way that I am. And I kind of felt like I was like a deadbeat in a lot of ways, even though I was making stuff. There was just something about like, okay, if this doesn't work, it's like, how long am I going to keep going thinking that this is like, it's definitely like, oh, you always say like, keep going, do what you love, all the thing. But when you're confronted with the realities of the world, sometimes I just felt like it wasn't fair for her to keep carrying me. You know, I was like, all right, maybe I'll take a break and I wanted to be a physicist before film. So maybe I'll go back and do that. So it was just, because there's a lot of stuff that comes up when you have a kid and also just like motherhood and she was working and you only get 4 months or 3 months of maternity leave. And that's not a lot of time. And you're leaving just as the kid is starting to kind of really see the world. And it's a very hard place to be,
right?
You know, to watch that and then to leave. And then it was like, it was the kind of thing where I was with him. So there was this kind of, there was something nice there, but it was just, I felt guilty, you know?
That's the thing, normal feeling.
Yeah.
So post Good Time, it works out. You're sort of like fortified in this pursuit of filmmaking.
Yes.
You're not going to go back to trying to be an astrophysicist.
Although I did end up, I did end up crossing paths with physics.
Yes.
You know, on Oppenheimer, which was, that was the craziest thing for me. I was like, when I was talking to Chris about it, I was just like, what? You don't even know. I said, literally, I was studying elementary particle physics, standard model. I was doing it all. I almost did that.
If Pattinson's not good in the movie, you could be right back there. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so when you're making Uncut Gems and Good Time, I'm curious about your specific role in this triptych you, your brother, and Ronnie have created. Because everyone I've asked about you and your work, they all mention one thing over and over and over again, which is you need to ask him about his role as a boom operator.
Yes.
And why you do that. Because it's fairly unusual. And for people who don't know, maybe you could describe what that is and why you do that.
Well, specifically on those, you know, there was this just by pure necessity. But in college, I've always loved sound design. So I would always learned it, loved it. And then when it came to making, I guess heaven knows what, it was so low budget. I was essentially running boom and recording sound, almost like a documentary. You know, I had it, I literally full on doing it. And then
while you're directing.
Yeah, because when you, the thing is what people don't realize is, except for boom ops, is you're right there. You're in the action with the actors. You're the only person who's really allowed to be in the room with them. And there's something that it did for specifically on Uncut Gems. Maceo was the camera operator and Maceo was the cinematographer on The Curse. We developed like an amazing kind of shorthand because when he was doing Steadicam, I'm right next to him. But you see the full body language. You're not just like looking at the specific frame. You're seeing how best to look at a scene and block a scene and stuff like that. And it just gives you another view and access point into the action that's happening.
How do you think doing that job informs both the way you direct and the way you act?
It's very, because you're listening, you're hearing everything. You just get a better sense of performance. And when you're acting in a scene, you can direct with from within because you're in control of what you say and how you respond, you know? And so you can navigate in a way that's helpful. And I think that that's just, that was, a running boom was a way for me to do that. It's also just like, it's very helpful because I'll also edit. So there's something about the sound and the way that it hits your head and your brain that when you hear it, you can kind of be like, okay, that's the cut point. And I don't, it's just, it's, you're almost in post-production in your head, you know, in some way.
Has it shaped you as an actor? I mean, you've done, since Uncut Gems, you've had this like 4 years of really wall-to-wall performing.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I like acting. And part of what I like about directing is I love performance. And I think performance is a very, it's fleeting. You know, there's something about being able to recreate an emotion that's not there and that's not real. And being in that moment, and it's almost like necromance. Like, isn't that like when bringing people back to, up from the dead? You know, it's that element. You're basically, you're playing with something like that where you're, and that's why it's not healthy.
Ronnie has this quote. He says he was trying to make a movie with you as an actor, but you wouldn't stop crying when trying to get into character.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, then if you want to take it all the way back, in acting, I've been able to get you are around a lot of different people, you know, and you're in different actors and you're able to learn from them and understand, you have conversations about craft and all that stuff. But I remember I was talking to Ellen Burstyn just about like crying and all this stuff.
Okay.
And what the, how do you do that? And I said, I don't know. I kind of create an emotional tornado where you kind of go into this weird place and you're thinking about all the stuff that happened to you, but you're kind of thinking around it in the situation. And she's like, oh yeah, that's it. She's like, you think about the smell of something and that triggers a different memory in your brain. And it was like, oh, there's an actual there's an actual thing that you do and learn in that way. And that my emotional tornado thing was that. But again, I don't necessarily know if you, like, you don't have to do it to feel it. You know what I mean? You can access something in your brain that allows you to feel it. And I guess with regards to performance, understanding kind of the subtleties and the details of something are helpful. You know, if I'm talking to you right now and I wanted to be like I was upset, you know, what do you do when you're upset? You kind of, you avoid eye contact and you'll just kind of like pause on your words and it gets really. So the thing is, what happens when you do that is it somehow taps into your brain of like, oh yeah, that's what I do when I'm upset. So then you kind of can't help it but get upset. And you start crying. And it is also, there's bad stuff that happened to me that you can kind of, I can go to and be like, oh, fuck, I don't want to have to feel that again.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I guess it's liberating to feel that way in front of people because you're always hiding those emotions. You know, you never want to cry in front of anybody. So when you do it, it can be liberating. It's embarrassing, but it is a liberating feeling, you know?
When you described it as a tornado, I was just wondering, like, what is in that flurry that comes to mind?
You're thinking around bad things and you're putting yourself in that position. It's not a good place to be. So
you said it wasn't healthy.
It, in a weird way, it is healthy, but it's not healthy to go to dip into that when you don't want to.
Right.
It depends on the levels of the tears. I know when I was working with Ronnie, it was weird because what was hard about that was the person I was playing ended up becoming the guy in Good Time, you know, and that was based on a lot of my own experiences and issues with mental health and OCD and all these things. And it was kind of overwhelming because with specifically with that character, I couldn't verbalize what it was that was hard for me. I was just coming up against a wall and I'm like, I wanted to say it, but I couldn't. And that was really sad. So I would start crying all the time because I'd be in these situations that were making me uncomfortable. Mm. But by nature of the character, I couldn't express myself. And that's sad. You know, if you feel something really deeply in your head and you understand it, but you can't say it, that's horrible.
Which is how I imagine, I think many people go through life like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the thing that is difficult. Because I have myself been in that position where I'm feeling something and I don't know how to say or verbalize it, what it is that I'm upset about.
Right.
And I think that with kids, that's the case more, you know, because you don't have the ability to speak or verbalize your opinions. But I guess it's, again, this is going back to this idea of recreating reality or whatnot. It's you're kind of trying to recreate the emotions that you feel. And that's just like, okay, what are these words that I have to say and how do they connect back into who I am? When Paul reaches out, I'm like, this is fucking awesome. Of course I'm going to do this, you know? He's one of the greatest ever. And
this is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes, and Licorice Pizza. And it was like, it was so unbelievable. And then, of course, what you see there, you can't help but learn and take it in. And then, you know, it's amazing to kind of have that experience, and it was just so fun. And there was a pushing and pulling of wanting to be your best that was so great. And then a similar thing happened, you know, when on Oppenheimer, everybody's kind of coming in at it trying to do their best.
Why don't we take a look?
Edward, the fact that we built this bomb does not give us any more right or responsibility to decide how it's used than anyone else.
But we're the only people who know about it.
I've told Simpson the various opinions of the community.
But what's your opinion?
Once it's used, nuclear war, perhaps all war, becomes unthinkable.
Until somebody builds a bigger one.
We're talking about this chapter of yours, and it reminded me of this documentary that appeared on Criterion about you and your brother, and it was in pre-production for Uncut Gems. Toward the end of the movie, you two are on the train, and you say, it's one of the first times we can see one or two things ahead, and we always thought the road ended at Gems. That basically every film you made up until that point was a stepping stone to Uncut Gems. And I guess I wondered, like, when that came out, and it did what it did, given that you couldn't imagine a life beyond it, how did you go about mapping the road ahead?
Well, that's the thing is it the practical meaning of that was after Daddy Long Legs, we wanted to make Uncut Gems. That was just the next thing we wanted to do. Wasn't in the cards. So we made a bunch of other stuff in between.
Right.
So when that was done, it was like, okay, not only is what do you do next, but it's also just a matter of you now have the ability to do something next. In the sense that you go back to like when I was before, is this something that I'm going to be able to do? Do I have to find another career to like provide?
Right.
And so it was the first time that that had happened, that you actually have, you can see a little bit into the future, you know? I think it was just a matter of like in that period, there was also a pandemic and all that stuff.
Did the pandemic and all these like new roles coming about that we've talked about, the yeah. Oppenheimer, like, yeah. Did it make you rethink wanting to direct with your brother?
I don't know. I was just kind of going with the flow.
Right.
That's all it was, is something came up. Hey, that sounds like fun. I would like to do that, you know? And then Jim Brooks calls me and says, hey, I want you to do this movie, the Judy Blume, Are You There, God? And Kelly calls me and she says she wants me to play a father. And I'm like, oh my God, nobody's ever asked me to play a father. I am a father. You know, I'm like, I'm a father of two kids in an interfaith marriage. Like, this is exactly what this movie is about.
Right.
Nobody has ever asked me to do that before. So I was like, this is a great place for me to express that part of who I am. It wasn't necessarily a conscious decision. It was more like, okay, this is a way for me to explore right now, you know, and it's all about learning. I think it's all part of one larger process, but the whole thing is a struggle to verbalize your emotions, because that's what all this is. Whenever you put anything down, you're trying to say something and you're trying to do something. So it's just a matter of, like, you're trying to figure out the best way to do that. And in certain moments, it's this. In other moments, it's this. But I think that they do talk to each other, and they allow you to get better and better yourself in a lot of ways. So
I wonder, as we look back and then look ahead, you know, like Daddy Long Legs, we said it was a way to relive your childhood, but it also killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And in thinking about Uncut Gems, I wonder, like, if it had the same effect in some ways. Like, it was a film that represented the shared ambitions and interests of you and your brother, literally starring the actor that raised you both and me.
Yeah.
And in making it, I don't know, did it kill some part of a shared dream, and did it open the door for something new?
It's funny, because I'm not thinking about it in that way. And when you pose the question, I'm like, oh yeah, that maybe, you know, but it's like, specifically with that movie, it was like, it had all this pent up demand, you know, and everything was kind of like, okay, now we have all these tools to tell this story, you know, and then you tell it and you're like, and again, it's this now what kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to do? And so that question just becomes kind of the guiding force. It's like, well, what do I want to do? I don't know. You know, what's interesting is right before the Gems, Nathan and I actually pitched The Curse in 2018. And then it stayed dormant until after. And then the pandemic hit. And then there was all this time. And then Emma came on board. And it was a whole long process to that. And it was, again, it was an organic kind of thing where you're just kind of letting things happen. And maybe that's, I guess, the key, is you don't want to set up a wall to avoid things that you don't necessarily know. You know, I'm far from, like, a Buddhist person. You know, I would love to be that. I have a hat that says be here now, you know. There's this idea that that's the place to be. And of course, if you're an anxious person, that's impossible. You know, you are there, but you're so in the now that it hurts. And then you're also thinking about the future. What's this? What's that? Or what about the past? How'd this happen? And you're kind of asking all these questions. But if you're open to what the world is going to show you, maybe you will be in a better place because you'll listen, you know?
I do. Well, I think as we leave, that moment where you figured out what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Do you remember that day in class you were, like, going to be an astrophysicist, and your teacher explained to you sort of story structure?
Oh, yes, yes.
Like, what happened that day to button this Oppenheimer thing up here?
Okay, so basically, this is in high school. I was part of this extracurricular science program where it was so much work. It was essentially as much time outside of school as in school. I would go and learn with this teacher at Columbia University. He was trying to set up all of these particle detectors on every school in the city. You create these small kind of garbage can with a photoelectric detector in the top. You line it with aluminum. There's something called Cherenkov radiation for when these high energy particles hit water. It emits this radiation as light. The light is picked up by the sensor. The sensor goes to a computer, which is on an oscilloscope, and it shows you the moment. If you have a moment at exactly the same time, because these things are moving at the speed of light, which is exactly the same speed, you can then trace from that moment back upwards to when the particle entered the atmosphere. So this idea that the more of these things you have, the bigger the detector, because things will happen at the same time. So anyway, that was what he was planning to do, and that's what I was helping try and prove as a proof of concept, whatever. But in that process, I have to explain that to somebody else. And part of the class was teach it to other people. And the process of taking that information that's internal in your head and having to say it to somebody else, that process is where you understand it. It's easy to understand, but to explain it is hard. So he was saying to me, he wrote down on the piece of paper, he's like, he said, I'm here at A. This is the end is at Z. And then he takes his pen and he just draws this horrific kind of spiral mess of like a snake. And then he finally ends up at Z. He goes, your job is to take me from A all the way to Z. Never let go of my hand, is what he said. Take me all the way along that path. And it's crazy, but if you get me from A to Z, I'll understand it. But then when you look behind you, you have no idea how you got there, but that's it. You understood it. So then I remembered seeing that, learning that, and then I think I watched The General by Buster Keaton. And I was like, oh, wait a second. This is the same thing. You know, you have this story that goes from A to Z, and it's complete madness and craziness all throughout it, but he's walking you through, and then the jokes are almost like physics problems, and you're at that moment, everything was kind of coming together in a lot of ways. And so I think what ended up happening was I went to school for both, and I realized you can't do that. You have to pick one. And so I picked movies, you know. I went to BU. Josh said, come to this class. It was a class on this guy, Ted Barron, who was a teacher there, and he showed a neorealist movie, and it was mind-blowing, you know. So that's when I was like, okay, maybe this is the wrong place for me, because you can't toe dip with both feet, you know, because they're in opposite directions. So you have to choose what it is that you want to do and do that. It's still very present in my mind, because the things I learned in physics tell me about narrative. You know, they tell me about story. And if you can explain something, then that also helps you with directing, you know, and because you can tell somebody, you can kind of walk them through the process. And so I like to think that everything is interconnected in that way. And it's a shame string theory is no longer like the right thing, because it made sense, you know. Feynman said, the world is a dynamic mess of jiggling things. And it's only based on perspective of whether or not you see it or not. For example, when you see an old newspaper on the ground and a rubber band is around it, let's say it's sitting there for 100 years. He goes, maybe the rubber band wouldn't last that long. But he goes, what's happening in that rubber band is you have all these particles banging when it's stretched. They're banging because it's getting heated up by the stretching of the rubber band. And those particles are banging the rubber band and keeping that newspaper together. He goes, that's how he sees the world. And that's crazy. And I remember I actually asked somebody, because there's in one scene, all the scientists from Los Alamos were actually in one of the scenes in Oppenheimer. It was a party. And so I was just talking to him and I said, that's something that I can't imagine going through the world like that. That would drive me crazy. And he looked at me and said, it would drive me crazy if I went through the world the way that you saw it. Because for me, there's some comfort in knowing that information, and to each his own, you know, and he's right. He's like, I feel I understand the world in a very deep and meaningful way. And that's okay. That when I look at a rubber band, I don't see a rubber band. I see beneath the rubber band and I see the particles moving. And that allows me to understand the world.
Well, we started this conversation talking about the surface level nature of the curse.
Yes.
We have now gone so far below.
Yes.
And I think we have hit something true and honest. And I'm glad you held our hands.
Okay. I hope so.
Through the process.
Every once in a while, I felt like maybe I let go and I looked back and I was like, oh, wait, where are
I have a long enough arm. It's okay.
Okay, good.
And to the young kid in college wondering if they should jump in and not just dip their toe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you jumped in, and I so look forward to seeing what's next.
Amazing. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Benny Safdie, a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, wherever you do your listening. If you'd like to go above and beyond sharing the program with a friend or posting on social media, all of that really does help new listeners find TalkEasy. Special thanks this week to Haley Benton Gates, Rael Shulman, Jennifer Vendetti, Christopher Nolan, and Jason Birch. I'd also like to thank Liz Mahoney and Narrative PR, Universal, and Showtime. You can watch new episodes of The Curse weekly on Paramount Plus or the Showtime On Demand app. If you'd like to learn more about the show or more about our guest, Benny Safdie, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. Once there, you'll find other great episodes with actors including Britt Marling, Oscar Isaac, Tom Hanks, Bill Hader, and Bob Odenkirk. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to join our mailing list, drop me a line at sf@talkeasypod.com. That's sf@talkeasypod.com. You can also purchase one of our mugs. They come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with writer Fran Lebowitz at talkeasypod.com/shop. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. Photographs today are by Julius Chu. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Cohen, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with another episode. Until then, stay safe and so long.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.